All right, today we're going to begin discussing Fantastes by George MacDonald. Just a quick little introduction on the author and the characters, etc., and then we're going to get into the worldview issue, which is all about Christian imagination, which is very important and very interesting, I think. The author is George MacDonald. He was a pastor from England, and he is known for his fairy stories. His fairy stories. The most famous of which is maybe Fantastes, but there's also Princess and the Goblin, or The Princess and Curdie. Have any of you read any of his fairy tale stories? I think you may have had to have read Princess and the Goblin earlier in your career here.
I think Adeline did.
Adeline did?
No, we read it for...
You read it for fun, or you read it for something else?
No, we read it for one of our classes.
He is one of the major influences on J.R.R. Tolkien, author of Lord of the Rings, and C.S. Lewis. When C.S. Lewis was a boy, he read Fantastes. And this is what he said. Now, if you don't know who C.S. Lewis is, please pack your bags and have a nice day. You need to go to government school. But I'm thinking everyone in here knows who C.S. Lewis is, author of The Chronicles of Narnia, the inventor of characters such as Aslan and the White Witch and Edmund. C.S. Lewis read this, and listen to what he said about Fantastes. I met there all that already charmed me in Mallory, Spencer, Morris, and Yeats. Talking about other poets and authors that he was inspired by. He met everything that he liked in them he found in Fantastes. But in another sense, all was changed. I did not know, and I was long in learning, which means it took me a long time to learn, the name of this new quality that I was discovering, that I was imagining in Fantastes. The bright shadow. Interesting. A bright shadow that rested on the shadows of Anadas. Anadas is the name of the main character. I do now know what that characteristic was, that new quality. It was holiness. Interesting. Holiness. What does holiness mean?
Other.
I'm sorry?
Set apart,
holy other. Fantastic, maybe? Fantastical? He said this, that night my imagination was, in a certain sense, baptized. The rest of me, not unnaturally, took longer. Right? My imagination, he says, was baptized. The rest of me took a little bit longer, meaning I didn't become a Christian for a long time later in my life. But when I read George MacDonald, my imagination became a Christian. Because the world of Fantastes is a world that has the Christian definition of truth, goodness, and beauty. It's a Christian world, so to speak, where the bad guys are bad and the good guys are good and good wins, etc. C.S. Lewis said, I had not the faintest notion what I had let myself in for by buying Fantastes. So when I was a boy and I bought this, I didn't realize what I was getting into. But this particular book changed my mind. It baptized my imagination. Now, to be baptized means that you have a new status. You have now entered into a new realm. You once were a cucumber and now you are a pickle. Right? That's your status has changed. You once were a child of Adam and now you are in the covenant and you are a son of God. So you've been baptized. His imagination was baptized by reading this particular book. And I think this book can change your worldview, change your life, in fact, because I think this book can change and alter your imagination if you read it carefully and thoughtfully. If you just skim over because you're just trying to get it done, you know, why waste your time? But if you read it carefully, with a sense of wonder and a sense of anticipation and expectation, I think it can do the same thing for you that it did for C.S. Lewis. It's one of the greatest fairy stories. It's one of the greatest works of imagination in the history of the world. All right? Now, the significance. First of all, think about it this way, and I've already sort of alluded to it. Humans have within them a desire for wonder, a desire for the unknown, a desire for the magical, the supernatural, the holy. Have you ever imagined something or invented a fantastical, a fantasy world? Right? I'm sure. Do you like fantasies? Have y'all, did you read any dragon novels or, right? Any of them you want to name real quick? What? Is it the gay dragon book?
Wings of Fire.
Yeah, I don't want to take away, but we were all sad when the dragon came out as gay in the seventh book. But that's, you know, we can't blame dragons for wicked authors. What other, any other fantastical stories or fantasies? Have you seen Dune? Dune's a sort of a dystopian, somewhere between a fantasy and a dystopian novel. Sci-fi is very similar to fantasy, but sci-fi is usually set on another planet or in the past, and it's also oftentimes very dystopian, you know, like Terminator or The Matrix. What?
Labyrinth.
Yeah, Labyrinth. That's a good one. Of course, you've all read Chronicles of Narnia because you've been, most of y'all have been in the school long enough to read that. Anybody, most of you have read Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit and all of that. All right, we have a desire for the Shire. Who would like to live in the Shire? Ooh, or visit, you know, Asgard. Ooh, we all have a desire for the fantastical. And fairy stories bring that out. They're pleasurable in the sense that they bring out that childlike sense of wonder. If you have a childlike sense of wonder. We all love to, I mean, just imagine this. You're walking in the woods behind your house and you come upon a giant wall that stretches as far as you can see all the way to the east and to the west. And the wall is covered in vines and ivy. Not ivy's not sitting on the wall. No, actual ivy. Let's go with Virginia creeper. All right, it's a type of vine. And as you walk along this wall, you notice animals scurrying in and out a particular portion of the vines, and you follow the trail, the little bunny rabbits, the squirrels, you know, a bobcat. You follow that particular trail to a particular spot in the vines. And as you pull the vines apart, you come across a large, about an 8-foot tall oak door with a golden doorknob. Now, who opens that door? Does anybody not open that door? Everybody opens that door. That's right. Everyone opens the door because we have a longing for the other. What's on the other side? What is through the veil, so to speak? It's ultimately satisfied in God, that sense of wonder, that sense of imagination, that attraction to the holy other. But we want to open the door and go in and discover what book was I getting that from? The Secret Garden. Yes, The Secret Garden, which is an amazing book, by the way. But we all want to discover the Secret Garden. We want to live in the Shire. We want to pass through the wardrobe into Narnia, right? We want to find the keys, right here, to a fairyland in the desk that we inherited from our grandfather, which is what's going to happen to Anadon in the chapter 1 of Phantastes, right? But of course, you have to have imagination to take all this in. You have to have a little bit of childlike wonder, right? And a lot of technology and screens and sugar and constant activity can rob you of that patience that you need to cultivate an imagination. You got to have a little patience. You got to have a work ethic. You know, it's like playing an instrument. Before you truly enjoy the instrument, you need long, hard hours of practice. It's like playing a sport. You know, I first started playing golf last year, and I'm just now getting to the point where I actually enjoy golf and not just hanging out and drinking beers with my friends. What I actually like doing is playing the actual game of golf. It's a miracle. It's like because I'm finally able to do it, I'm finally, you know, getting the sense of it. As you study and as you read and you pay attention and you put in the time and the effort into Phantastes, it will have a huge payoff in your imagination. You will, through reading this book, be opening up the door into the secret garden, so to speak. And it'll be worth it all. At least C.S. Lewis tells it was worth it all, right? All right. Also, because I love historical fiction, you're going to see some allusions to historical events. You're certainly going to see some allusions in the book to mythological characters like King Arthur. one of the knights in Fantastes is one of the knights of King Arthur and his Round Table. You're also going to see some allusions to Sir Gawain and the Green Knight, which y'all read, I think, a couple of years ago in 7th or 8th grade. All right, let's write down the main characters. First one is Anados, or Anados, A-N-A-D-O-S. Which means wayward or pathless. Pathless. So as Anadon enters fairyland, he's sort of wayward. Not in the sense that he is running to wickedness and evil, but in the sense of being like a sheep. He's a little, you know, he's got a good heart, so to speak, kind of. Got an evil shadow. Got to deal with that. But he's kind of wanders around fairyland, right? And sometimes that gets him into trouble, but oftentimes he discovers great wisdom and great beauty. He is part fairy himself, Anadon. He's got a touch of fairy blood. And he has a gift. His superpower, his gift, is the gift of poetry. And this book is, and this is a bold print word, a coming of age story. A coming of age story. Like The Summer I Turned Beautiful. Which I have no idea what that's about. But I can just tell it's a coming of age story. He's 21 when the book starts. And he's learning in the book what it means to truly be a man. What it truly means to be a man. Other characters include the animals in the forest, the trees in the forests, the beech tree in particular, symbolizing wisdom, and the ash tree, a brutish tree of domination and foolishness and wickedness. Can anyone think of any particular book of the Bible that has a young man and he is on a journey to Lady Wisdom and running away from, you know, the foolish lady, the harlot? What book of the Bible teaches that? It's Proverbs. That's where George MacDonald is getting that particular theme. Remember, he's a pastor too. Another character, which is not really a character, but kind of a character, is Anadas' shadow. Of course, shadows don't exist, but they are a thing. It's interesting. What is darkness really? Is it a thing, or is it the absence of a thing? Did God create darkness, or has there always been darkness? It's interesting. I believe he created it, so to speak. Then you have Sir Percival, who is the knight. Sort of an embarrassing knight, loaded down with his failures in rusty armor. You'll think of the Rusty Tin Man, which may have been inspired from this. And eventually, though, he becomes courageous and chivalrous as a good knight should be. And Sir Percival loves the White Lady. He loves the White Lady, another very important character. All right, so let me summarize the story before we get into the worldview and the discussion of the various philosophical aspects. But the summary is interesting because this book is not like a typical book with a start, a middle, and an end with a narrative arc. It's a bit like a wandering dream. Have you ever had a dream that kind of went from random scene to random scene? Yeah. I had a dream last night, actually, that some people were coming over to the house that I find incredibly awkward, and I really didn't want to be there for it. But there was another person showed up at the house, and they said I could leave with them. And I was like, that would be fantastic. And I looked out the window, and they were in a Formula One racing car. Like convertible racing car, and I can hear it revving up. Rom, rom. And I was like, oh, this is going to be great. I can't wait to go. So not only am I getting out of this awkward thing, I'm getting to go on this awesome trip in a Formula One race car. But I couldn't get my shoes off. And so my shoes were too tight, and I was trying to get them off my feet. And the people were coming to the house, and if they saw me, it would be too late. And I'd be stuck in the awkwardness. And the car is being revved. It's ready to go. And I can't get my stinking shoes off. And I'm trying the laces, and laces are knotted up. And then finally, my alarm goes off, and I wake up. It's the story of my life. It's sort of frustrating. But no, but dreams are like that. Just random. They kind of go from here, go from there. New characters jump in. Old characters jump out. That's sort of how this book is. Reading this book, some other people say reading this book is like listening to music. Sort of like, you know, like how do you summarize an orchestra? Yeah, you just sort of, you enjoy it, right? So you go from one scene to the next, and you sort of just take it all in. So kind of what you're trying to enjoy when you're reading fantasies, you're not just enjoying the narrative or the plot. You understand what I mean? You're enjoying the words. You're enjoying the pictures. You're supposed to imagine it in your mind as you read it. Make sense? Which brings us to another term, bold print this, imagination. Imagination. What is imagination? It is the ability to create images. The ability to create images, let's just say in your mind. But of course, it can come out of your mind into your art, right? Storytelling, songwriting, novel writing, artwork, animation. But to have an imagination is to have the ability to create images. Okay? And God has given us the ability to create images for a reason. Animals, I don't think, have an imagination. Do they dream? I wonder. It looks like my dog is dreaming sometimes when he's sleeping. He's dreaming of just sausage raining from heavens. I'm not sure. Something like that. Now, to understand imagination, I need to go back and just ask you some questions just to warm up and to get to the point where we can understand imagination. Let me ask you this. Is seeing believing? Now, I want you to put into your database everything we've learned about Plato, Aristotle, about empiricism, that is the discovery of knowledge through the senses, through seeing, touching, tasting, smelling, through reason, which is rationalism. Is seeing believing? Do you have to see something to believe in it? No. Is there, what do you not see that you believe in? God. Okay, good. The spiritual realm. All right, so seeing is not necessarily believing for you, but there have been people, like remember Epicurus was much more heavy on the sensory aspects of in Epicureanism. Not totally, but much more heavy than others. Let's think about Noah's Ark. Have you ever seen Noah's Ark? Do you believe in it? Okay. Can you imagine it? Can you create a mental picture of Noah's Ark in your mind? So is it real? Is it real?
A mental picture?
Interesting. It's interesting. It's real to you though, right? Do you believe it? And you can see it. You see it in your mind because you created a picture of it with your imagination. You know, there's someone that I was talking to the other day and they don't believe in Noah's Ark. And I said, well, why? What is it? Is it because you don't think, you know, all the animals could fit on the ark, or you think that a global flood is implausible because of this scientific proof and that scientific proof? Or, and they're like, no, I just feel like if there's Noah's Ark, we would see it. It would be like, it would be there somewhere, like in the mountains. Huh? I don't know about that. Right. And I was like, well, so you don't believe in Noah's Ark just because we haven't found it, because you can't see it? I was like, there's a lot of things you believe in that you don't see. I mean, do you believe in George Washington? Do you believe in Abraham Lincoln? You've never seen either of those two guys. You believe they exist based on the testimony of others. Well, this person didn't really want to believe, and so they didn't believe. But you believe in Noah's Ark, and you can see it in a mental picture that you create in your mind. That's what we call imagination. And it's very important. God gave it to us for a reason. Let me put it to you another way. Do you believe in heaven? The New Jerusalem?
Yeah.
Can you see it?
No.
Have you heard about it?
Yeah.
Have you read about it in the Bible?
Yeah.
Can you see it in your mind, though?
Yeah.
If you go to a church that teaches the Bible, and over a long period of time, you've learned a lot about the Bible, especially if you learn Revelation chapter 21, you've learned the Bible's description of the New Jerusalem, and you can sort of create a mental picture in your head. Right? Make sense? Let me read it for you and see if you can do this. All right? Revelation 21:10. And he carried me away in the spirit to a great high mountain. This is John. He's having a vision. And he's up on top of a great high mountain. And he showed me the holy city, Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God. A massive city coming out of heaven Can you imagine that? Who here has in their mind the picture of the Emerald City from Wizard of Oz? Who just imagined the Emerald City floating down from heaven on the Wizard of Oz? Y'all seen the Wizard of Oz, right? The yellow brick road, in my mind, when I imagine the New Jerusalem coming out of heaven, I am picturing this Emerald City floating down out of heaven. None of y'all? What are you picturing?
A cloud, like a Greek city.
It's a city, like a Greek city. You have a Greek city in your mind, like Athens? With
lots of gold, pearly gates, like all white, big.
Interesting. I also have, when I was a little kid, I read Pilgrim's Progress, and on the cover was the Celestial City that he was walking to go to. And I kind of have the Celestial City, an amalgamation of the Celestial City with the Emerald City. And there's obviously a connection between those two, poetically. But here we have, in Revelation, we have the city of Jerusalem coming down out of heaven from God, having the glory of God. So who's picturing that? What does that look like in your mind? Oh, that's the music that's playing. Oh, you imagine you can hear it. Very bright light. It's radiance like a most rare jewel, like a jasper, clear as crystal. So can you picture in the diamond, and the way when the sunlight shines on the diamond, it's refracting and reflecting in all kind of different directions. Shooting rainbows, maybe. Right? It had a great high wall with 12 gates, and at the gates, 12 angels. Who's picturing it in their mind? You see what's happening? Do you believe in it? You believe in it, why? Because our axiom around here is that the Bible is true. And we can come to know ultimate truth by studying and learning what is revealed by God in the Bible. That's faith. Faith is, let me read it for you. Faith is the, assurance of things hoped for. Who hopes for heaven? Who's assured, at least to some degree, that you have it? That's faith. And faith is also the conviction of things that you don't see. So you don't see heaven, but you believe it is real. That's faith. That's a gift from God. But what can help your faith is the ability to imagine it in your mind. Oh, boy. Let me give you another one. Oh, by real quick, is it okay to imagine images of God and then bow down and worship him? No. Okay, good. We're not doing that. We're not talking about the violations of the second commandment. We're just talking about imagination. All right? Genesis 1, 1 through 3. Now, some of you who are in my Bible study, you've already done this, but let's do it again for the rest of you. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. The earth was without form and void, and darkness was over the face of the deep. And the Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the waters. So can you picture it? You have the earth in space, darkness, space. And there is the earth, and the earth is covered in waters, the deep. And there's no light, it's dark. It's like the beginning of a sci-fi novel, a watery planet. And then all of a sudden it says the Spirit of God hovered. Now it's interesting, that word in Hebrew, hovered, is fluttered, as a dove would flutter over its nest. So you have the picture of a hovering spirit. You can't see a spirit, so you kind of have to substitute in for that something in this world. If you go over to the Psalms, it says that he clothed himself in light on the day of creation. And so you kind of can imagine a shiny, bright cloud hovering over the earth, a giant, bright, shining cloud hovering over the earth. And then look what happens. And God saw that the light was good. So there's light. Is there a sun? There's no sun. There's this cloud, this shining brightness. And God separated the light from the darkness. So now there's light and darkness, which may mean something like the earth began to spin. So now one side of the earth has light and the other side has dark. God called the light day, and the darkness he called night. And there was evening and there was morning the first day. But you still picture that watery world having a daytime and a nighttime, right? With the cloud of glory hovering in the middle of space. Can you picture all of that? Now, we believe that in creation, but these words help us to picture it in our minds. That's imagination. And imagination can help faith. It can help faith. Of course, it's not the same thing as faith, though, right? A couple more terms for you real quick. Percept, a percept, P-E-R-C-E-P-T, percept. It's a picture we have in the mind from our senses. So those mental pictures that you were imagining, they're called percepts, P-E-R-C-E-P-T, related to the word perception. When someone has a perception, it's not necessary, it's the connotation is that it's not reality, it's a twisting or what's going on in their imagination. But a percept is a picture in the mind. You, so far in this class, you've had a percept of the New Jerusalem, a percept of the first day of creation. And let me give you a percept right now. Shrek.
No.
All right. Did that just happen?
Yes.
That percept is named Shrek. All right. I give you another percept. Spider-Man. All right, good. Now, the second... No. I messed that up. That's not a percept. I messed that up. I'm going to give you a percept right here. I'm going to hold up this book. You're going to look at this book, and then you're going to picture it in your mind. That's a percept. All right? That's a percept. It's something when you get a mental picture in your mind by seeing it. Okay? By seeing it. For example,
Think of the Mona Lisa.
The Mona Lisa. You've seen it before, though, right? That's a percept. Good, good.
So wouldn't Shrek and Spider-Man...
Shrek and Spider-Man would be percepts because you've seen them before. You've seen them before, right? But now, a phantasm... So I was right about that, sorry. I was confused. Phantasm, an image, and this is the second thing, a phantasm, which of course is what the name of this book is, Fantastes. Phantasm is an image that you have in your mind that you conjured from your own imagination. You didn't see it. You didn't taste it. You didn't touch it. You didn't smell it. It's a phantasm. Now, I don't know. I have to do some more research to see, is a phantasm... Can a phantasm be of something you've seen before but you're not currently seeing at the moment? I think so. Like if I were to say to you, donut, the thing that's in your mind, can you taste it? You can kind of imagine what donuts taste like right now, can't you? Mesh's donuts? Right? You can't imagine what they taste like? Then if I brought one in here, you wouldn't want it?
Yes,
you would want it because you kind of know, and you can. Ooh, yeah. Interesting. How about this? A fairy. Get the phantasm in your mind. Go ahead. Get the phantasm in your mind, and now, Jude, describe a fairy to me, and don't describe anyone in this class.
Stick man.
Ooh, long, skinny.
Little old person. Chilling in the grass.
Chilling, they always chilling. They always be chilling.
I just thought of Tinkerbell.
Yeah, you thought of Tinkerbell from the movie. Good, that's a phantasm. So this book, as you read it, is filled with phantasms. This is fairy world. This is not a world of that you see, touch, taste, or smell. This is a world that he enters into through a key that he finds at his grandfather's desk. And it's a world of imagination, of dreams. It's a world in the mind. All right? But, and here's the thing that I really want you to think about, okay? Does that which you imagine in your mind, that donut, that fairy, is it real? That's the question. Is it real?
Nope.
In the matrix of your mind, is it real?
Mm-hmm.
Well, another term for you. Mythopoeia. M-Y-T-H-O-P-O-E-I-A. This is a epic story or a giant story filled with legends and myths that takes place in an entire other world, a mythopoeia. That world could be through a desk, or through a cupboard, or through a wardrobe, or through a fence in a wall, or through a black hole, or through some sort of a space-time continuum, you know, Stargate. But it's another world, all right? When you write a book like Tolkien did, or Lewis, or Dune, that involves a giant story, an epic story, taking place in a whole other world, what's that called? A mythopoeia. That's right. Lord of the Rings is a mythopoeia. Hobbit is a mythopoeia. All right? And when you read these types of stories, what's happening? What is happening? You're beginning to imagine this world in your mind. You're imagining the world, and you're imagining all the characters in the world. Who can right now, who, raise your hand if you read Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit. Who can imagine Frodo? Now, this is the bummer with movies, because you're imagining the Frodo from the movies. Movies, in some sense, can steal imagination away from you. They can sort of steal your, they can steal the world out of your brain and put the director's imagination into your brain. That's why being a director is a very powerful art form, a very powerful position in art. But you can imagine a world, and it's in your mind, and you can imagine all the characters. Can you imagine what they might do in certain circumstances? Right. Now, but the question is that a real world? God, does God have an imagination? Yes, he created this world. He wrote the first mythopoeia. But he has the ability to make what he imagines. We're trying to understand very complicated things here, but he can create what he imagines and make it real. Can we create what we imagine and make it real? Yeah, through we can write it, we can draw it, we can speak it, we can tell it, right? We can cook it up in the kitchen. But you can imagine a certain type of donut. Imagine a new type of donut. Can you do it? That you've never seen before or eaten before. How about a bacon donut? Okay, well, how about
a rainbow donut. Bananas. Ice cream donut.
Interesting. Donut ice cream. No one's ever had it, but can you imagine it? You could imagine it. Then you could get into the kitchen and you could create it. You see how that's why we are like God in that sense. Not exactly like God, obviously. We can't just create with our words. We have to, you know, by the sweat of our brow, we bring things into fruition. But we can imagine. You can imagine a world, and you can create that world through art, through writing. Right? See what I'm saying? We're getting into some interesting stuff here. When you read this book, you're going to be imagining a world. Make sense? Mm-hmm. And that world is what C.S. Lewis called a second reality. It's a second reality. We could call it the mental matrix. And it is real. It's real in a sense. Does it have an effect on you? Do you think that what you imagine has an effect on you? Yeah. Sure. Donut ice cream might drive you into the kitchen to create this beautiful new concoction that makes the world go mad. And you become a multi-billionaire because of this idea that you had, that you made a reality. Ideas have consequences in the real world. What you can imagine, you can achieve, right? If you can visualize it to some effect, it makes a difference. You're not God, you can't speak things into existence, but it does make a difference in the way you live, right? What if these stories that you're reading, C.S. Lewis's Chronicles of Narnia,
20,000
Leagues Under the Sea, right? The Dragon Book. What's it called? Wings of Fire. Harry Potter. Secret Garden. Dune. What if all of these imaginary worlds, they're in your mind with all of these characters, and they are actually affecting your actual reality? The second reality affects the ultimate reality. You think that's possible? It's definitely possible, right? Have you ever been doing something as a kid, something chivalrous and courageous, and you imagine yourself being a character that you had read about in a book? Mm-hmm. Right? Who? Can you think of any? If you thought about it, you could come up with some. Sir Arthur, you've done some heroic deeds, and you imagined yourself being King Arthur. When you were little, you mean a couple days ago? Yeah. Right. That's okay. Don't be embarrassed. Look, I remember when I was a young teacher. I was about 27 years old. I was with I'd get out a teacher's meeting. It was a very elderly teacher that he and I, we always talked. And we had class right next to each other. And so we always walked from teacher's meeting to class together. And he was an ex-Marine. And I had just gotten out of the Army. And when we would walk, I would imagine, like, we're going to class. I had, like, imaginations in my mind of being, like, a crusader. You know what I mean? Like a medieval knight going into battle. Or like a Saxon in the shield wall facing down with the giant blonde-haired, blue-eyed, horned-hat Viking. Because I read a lot of historical fiction. So I had a lot of, like, historical references in my... I didn't read a ton of fantasy. So I didn't have a lot of fairies and goblins in my imagination bank, but I had a lot of historical characters in my imagination bank, and I can remember imagining those sorts of things. That's normal. It inspires you. It makes you courageous. Who here knows who Reepicheek is? He's very tiny and funny, but what else do we know about Reepicheek? Huh? He's noble. That's right. You see, when characters like Reepicheek get into your brain, they can inspire you to be noble and to be courageous, even though you're just a little mouse. It can affect you like that. It has this huge kind of an impact on you. When my kids were selfish when they were little, I used to always tell them that they were turning into Gollum. Because they knew it. They knew what that meant. I would go, "My precious." And they would laugh and sort of repent from what they were doing, because they realized that his obsession with the ring made him gross and ugly and mean and isolated from community and from others. They had this character, Gollum, and this world loaded into their brain from the stories, and it became a reality in their minds that affected the actual reality, the incarnational, fleshly reality.
Mully Grub
is one my dad made up. But then you have other stories that aren't Christian. Like Fantasties is Christian. It's a Christian world in the sense that up is up and down is down, and virtue is virtue and evil is evil. But you have pagan stories like we read in the Battle of Troy, right? Where Achilles, is he heroic? Is Achilles heroic? Not in the Christian sense, but in the pagan sense, he's heroic and powerful and strong. But what's his motivation? It's all for vain glory and selfishness. What if you have a whole culture that all their myths and all their legends have these twisted characters and these twisted worlds? You could see how that's going to have an impact on the culture. You see what I'm saying? If Achilles was your childhood hero, as he was for many people, you could see how that would have a negative impact on your life and on the world that you created out here in the real world, right? If what you imagined to be beautiful and delicious wasn't an ice cream donut, but was I hate bananas, but some people like them. It was a cow pie donut. Then what you created in the, that's a pile of manure, you know, what you created in the kitchen would be disgusting. If your culture is twisted and the stories they tell are twisted. That's why it's important for Christians to tell good stories. Make sense? That's why it's important for Christians to draw beautiful things and to write and to tell their children stories and to give their children the right kind of books and watch the right kind of shows. What if your childhood brain and the imagination has all of the things filled up from television? What's going to happen? Do you think that's going to have an impact on them? Yeah. Yes, because the television is creating worlds and characters and even making them so you can see them with your eyeballs, so it goes straight into your imagination, and then it's not a Christian world, and it doesn't have Christian values and virtues. My two mommies, or whatever. That's like, that's the worst case scenario, but it's cartoons like Caillou, and he's like a selfish little spoiled brat, right? Those sort of things are just going into your brain, and it makes a big difference. So, anyway, when we read Fantasties, because we're actually going to read this together in class, what I'm hoping is that when you see Rusty Sir Percival in his rusty armor and sad from all of his failings, when you see him become noble and courageous and, you know, win the battle and properly and courageously love the white lady. I'm hoping that you see something that sticks in your mind and inspires you, right? And I hope when you see Anna Don fall in love with sort of a marble lady and fall head over heels for kind of a harlot, and you can see all the foolishness and the difficulty that brings in his life and how he repents of that and finally has victory over it, that too can lock into your brain and go into your life and help you as well. Make sense? All right. Well, that'll be it for today.